Why radio? What brought you to radio, and when did you fall in love with radio?
Wow. Well, my coming to radio was a complete and total accident. I had written an op-ed piece when I was living and working in Cleveland where I talked about how, in my opinion, racism was no longer a major problem in America. And I get a phone call from a producer of a radio show I never heard of, and he said, "Are you black?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You don't believe that racism is a major problem in America?" Now, keep in mind, this was probably like 1990 that I wrote this. And I, he said, "Would you mind coming on my guy's show and talk about this?" I said, "Sure." So I came on. I was on for an hour. And as you know, that's an eternity. And I was called a bootlicking Uncle Tom, a foot shuffling bootlicking Uncle Tom, a coconut, an Oreo, the Antichrist. And I was called the name you really call a black man when you really want to hurt his feelings. I was called Republican. And so I, after that hour, I said, "I'll never do that again." I get back home. The station manager calls. He says, "You were amazing today." I said, "I was." "Oh, my goodness, you were funny. You took difficult positions. You defended them without losing your sense of humor. You have a good speaking voice. Have you ever thought about doing talk radio?" And I said, "No." He said, "I've got a guy going on vacation next week. Will you sit in for him?" I said, "No." He said, "Why?" I said, "I don't like yelling at people. I don't like being yelled at." He said, "Are you married?" At the time, I was. He said, "Do me a favor. Go home to your wife and talk it over and call me back tomorrow." I said, "I'll do that, but I doubt that I'll change my mind." So I went home. I mentioned it to my then-wife, Cindy. And she said, "Well, what do you think about talk radio?" I said, "I don't know anything about it other than it seems shallow, glib, and stupid." She said, "It is. You'd be good at it." So I agreed to sit in for that 1 week, and I loved it. And I made some tapes, sent it out to L.A. to get a job in radio. Nobody cared. I met Dennis Prager. Dennis Prager had me on his radio show. He loved me so much, he literally asked management to consider me. Management gave me a two-day audition. After 1 day, they made me an offer, and I've been on radio ever since.
Is Larry Elder an optimist?
Absolutely. I am a what did I tell Dennis Prager once? I'm guardedly pessimistic. I'm not happy with the way the country's going. I'm not happy with the fact that young people have a more positive view of socialism than they do of capitalism. I'm not happy with the way young people don't seem to understand the values of this country. I'm not happy with the domination of what I call the axis of indoctrination. That's Hollywood, academia, and media. And in my opinion, they are, if not winning, they certainly are a formidable force. I mean, you look at some of the things that just happened in the last few days. Drew Brees makes some innocuous statement about never agreeing with anybody who disrespects the flag. He didn't say, "I would never play with them. I would never want them on my team. I want to get management to excise them. I want to have the NFL change the rule." He said nothing like that. All he said is, "I will never agree with it." And 2 days later, or whatever it was, he apologizes and apologizes again. Then his wife apologizes. A editor of the New York Times resigns because he approved an op-ed piece by a responsible citizen, Tom Cotton, that simply said, if this violence continues, the National Guard may have to be called in, which is a position of the majority of the American people. So an op-ed piece that articulates the position of the majority of the American people, that is a position written by a responsible member of the Senate, nobody's flamethrower, and 800 staffers in the New York Times rebel, and the editor that approved the op-ed piece resigns. Philadelphia Inquirer, a longtime editor, approved a headline about a story about rioters burning up the place, and the headline was "Buildings Matter Too," and that was deemed by staffers to be insensitive, and he resigns. This is nuts. And you've got Van Gordon Salter, the former head of CBS News, writing an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. And he says, "Look, I've been in this business for 35, 40 years. I've never seen it this biased. I've never seen people take positions like this. The only salvation is for media to come clean and say, we are biased to the left, and we're going to filter our news through that prism. At least you'll be honest to the readers instead of lying to them." This is the former head of CBS News saying this. So it's my long answer to your question, am I an optimist? I think that the captain aboard the ship Titanic, had he known the iceberg was ahead, would have taken evasive action. It's our job to tell the American people there's an iceberg ahead, and we need to take evasive action.
I love that. I love that long answer to the question. So, Larry, I've watched you and heard you debate for years. One thing you almost, Tavis Smiley notwithstanding, almost never get pushback on are your facts that you bring to the party. Do facts matter? When it comes to the great debate, do facts actually matter?
Well, that's a good question, and that's why I've done this documentary called Uncle Tom, because people like myself who are conservatives, people like Candace Owens and Herman Cain and Alan West, rather than defeat us on the basis of our ideas, rather than say you are wrong, here's why, it's you're an Uncle Tom, you're a sellout, you're a bootlicker. I've said many times on my show, the word that I most fear is not being called Uncle Tom, not being called bootlicker, not being called any of these things. The word I fear the most is being called wrong. And rarely am I. When I talk about the fact that last year, for example, according to the Washington Post, 9 black men, black people, were shot and killed by the police versus 19 whites shot and killed by the police. Around 15, unarmed black men were shot and killed by the police, 19 unarmed white men shot and killed by the police. Altogether, around 15 unarmed blacks were killed by the police, because some were killed with means other than guns. It's still lower than the number of whites that were killed in the year 2019 at 19. Am I wrong about that? Am I wrong about the fact that according to the CDC, the percentage of police shootings against blacks in the last 56 years has declined 75%? Am I wrong about the fact that a young black boy is 8 times more likely to be a victim of a homicide than a young black man? And almost always that young black homicide victim is killed by another young black man. Am I wrong about that? Am I wrong about how rare it is for the police to kill anybody, let alone a black person, let alone an unarmed black person, let alone a white cop shooting an unarmed black person? Almost never happens. You're almost more likely to be struck by lightning as a black man than to be a black unarmed man killed by the police. Am I wrong? So isn't this good news? Shouldn't you be smiling about this, that these things can be explained for reasons having nothing whatever to do with racism? Why am I a bad guy for bringing these facts to the table?
Yeah. Did Tavis Smiley ever get those facts? Are you still waiting from 2012?
That was a double team. That was Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. And so it was 2-1, so therefore it was a fair fight. No, they've never gotten back to me. And the issue was whether or not under Ronald Reagan, black adult unemployment fell faster than white adult unemployment, as I asserted. Hispanic adult unemployment fell faster than white adult unemployment. Teen black unemployment fell faster than teen white unemployment. Am I wrong about all these things? Tavis said I was wrong. He's going to give me the real facts on my desk on Monday. That was what, 10 years ago? Snail mail, come on.
Right. What do you do to unwind? I mean, you have, in the eyes of many, obviously, you very what could be deemed as a very stressful job and environment, hostile. What does Larry Elder do to unwind?
Wow, these are interesting questions nobody ever asks. Nobody ever cares. Not much. I have a very pleasant girlfriend that I've been with for almost 15 years. And we love going to dinner. We love doing simple things. We're not flashy people. I think coming home and having a nice dinner and watching a good movie is pretty much what I do when I unwind. It's pretty boring. This is kind of 24/7. I mean, as you know, yeah. You're in the business. The news cycle never ends, so your antenna are always up. And in my case, I do 2 videos per week for Epic Times, and they're pretty labor intensive. I put 2 of them up every day. We of course also do videos for the video channel that I'm doing with Salem called the Larry Elder youtube.com/TheLarryElderShowRadio. And I write a column once a week, which I've been writing ever since April of 1998. I've published about 6 books. And it's a great deal of time to prepare for the radio show, at least 3 hours a day for the show prep time, sometimes a lot longer. So you add all that stuff up, there's not a whole lot of time left.
To unwind, no doubt. Well, to many looking at Larry Elder, you got the world by the tail. And I know you have a lot of antagonists out there, but nevertheless, you really have done a remarkable job in your career over the last 25, 30 years. So my question is, you must have had goals, I imagine, when you started, when you became a lawyer, when you then moved into radio. Do you still set goals for yourself? And have you found a system that works really well for you?
Well, if someone had told me what I would have achieved 25 years ago, what I've achieved 25 years later, I would have told them they were insane. I won an Emmy. I won a local Emmy. My star is on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, for crying out loud, on the corner of Hollywood and Vine. Can you believe it? I've had 2 nationally syndicated TV shows. One was a court show called Moral Court. One was a show called The Larry Elder. Both were, in my opinion, quality shows. They didn't get picked up, but they were both quality shows. And I'm a New York Times bestselling author, which I never, ever expected. So I've got a whole lot of stuff to be happy about. I told my mother and father a long time ago that I'm playing with house money. I suppose if I have any itch left, I've always wanted to have a national talk show along the lines of Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity, and that never really happened. And now I'm almost 70 years old. It probably won't happen. I'm not angry about it and not disturbed about it, and I'm not losing any rest over it, but that would have been nice.
Give President Trump a grade, would you, on his handling of the recent rioting and looting and maybe the coronavirus pandemic. How is the Trump administration doing, in Larry Elder's opinion?
Well, in general, I give him an A. Given the failure of China to level about when this virus was first discovered, about how it's transmitted, the fact that China misled the World Health Organization, which in turn misled the CDC. I don't put that at Trump's feet. I know that Trump instinctively did not want to shut down the economy. You know he was pushing back on that, and it turns out his instincts were right. And regarding these riots in the streets, I don't know what this has to do with Trump. I think that Trump has come in and he's backed law enforcement in a way that Barack Obama did not. Law enforcement was very unhappy with Barack Obama. There were all sorts of things that happened during Barack Obama's second term. There were two officers that were killed execution style in New York, three killed execution style in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and five killed execution style in Dallas, Texas. And nobody suggested that Obama's anti-cop rhetoric had anything to do with it. So how is it that Trump's pro-cop rhetoric has to do with the fact that some cop in Minneapolis, four cops in Minneapolis, did something that I've not heard any cop justify? So I think Donald Trump is handling it just perfectly well. I think the Democrat mayors are not handling it very well. And I think people are getting to see the end game of what happens when you have a town and a state that's run by one party.
If the internet can be believed, and I put a big asterisk next to that, Ayn Rand's book, The Fountainhead, had an impact on you when you read it. I take it probably early in your life. Any lasting takeaway? I love that book. And the reason I'm asking that is because I love The Fountainhead. I thought that was, I liked it as much, if not more, than Atlas Shrugged. But what impact did it make on you?
Well, I identified with the architect, with Rourke. The idea that you have a vision and you want your vision to be realized without it being compromised by other people. Who could not relate to that? It was a magnificent book. And I think it's one of the greatest pieces of American literature. I thought she was amazing. I'm not an objectivist in the sense I'm not an atheist. She was an atheist and kind of ridiculed people that believed in God, kind of thought it was to believe in fairy tales. So that's probably my only objection to her. But in terms of limited government, personal responsibility, what happens when you burden people who are producers, you decrease their incentive and you decrease the incentive of the people that you give stuff to. So that's kind of her overall philosophy, and I think it's a sound one.
Would you be welcome at a Black Lives Matter rally, do you think?
No, I don't think I would be. I think Black Lives Matter is the whole concept that black lives are more important than anybody else's lives is racial chauvinism that I don't participate in, and I reject the premise. If anything, the data show that the police are more hesitant, more reluctant to pull the trigger against a black person than a white person. So why is there a need for a Black Lives Matter when the premise itself is faulty? So given that, I don't think I'd be invited, and if I were invited and if I said that, I'd probably have to wear a flak jacket.
And definitely don't wear a MAGA hat.
Right.
I know your time is limited. It's valuable, and I appreciate you spending it with us here. By the way, you've got legions of fans. I mean, Alaska is a small, populous state, large state, very small populous, but you have legions of fans. People love you here, and you're welcome. And please come to Alaska. Thank you for your time.
Chris, I was in Alaska in 19, I think it was 70... 78, 79-ish. It's when the Dodgers were playing the New York Yankees in the World Series and Reggie Jackson hit those three home runs in a row. I know that because I kind of took a hooky from the law firm I was working for when I was in Anchorage and in Fairbanks to watch the World Series. And I remember meeting a young lady who worked in the office. Her name was Susan Smalls. She was the most delightful young lady I ever met. I never, ever said anything to her ever since then, but she's still very likely living in Alaska, and if she's listening to your show, maybe she'll hear it. Hello, Susan Smalls. I was working for Sohio at the time. It's now called British Petroleum, and the law firm that I worked for represented one of them, and we were doing some legal work for the Alaskan pipeline, and that's where I met her.
It is a small world, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, it is.
So just another question or two, because, again, in fairness of time, and you've got to run, but I get triggered, Larry, and I grew up in Alaska in a small town, 4,000 people, and I knew a couple, I think two two black people in all of my life until I turned 18, moved to Anchorage and met a gentleman named Jesse Kennedy, and he took me in. He had an African-American line of hair products, and that's how I met him, selling him things for that business of his. But he was also a private detective, and he took me in, and he made me a partner in his detective agency. We became fast friends, and we'd have these conversations about race. And I'd say, but Jesse, you could do anything you want. And he said, no, I've been held back and this and that. And I pointed out Sidney Poitier because he wanted to be in the movies. He grew up in the 40s and he wanted to be into the movies and he couldn't and he didn't get his break. And I said, what about Sidney Poitier? And he goes, you can point to one person. Anyway, we went back and forth, but I loved him. He was a great guy and I learned a lot. We'd go on stakeouts and I think mainly for the snacks I was there. I enjoyed that. But I get triggered when I hear the term white privilege and I don't know why. What do you think when you hear that term?
Yeah. Well, let me answer it this way. When I was growing up from the second grade on, I had a very close friend. And my very close friend was probably the most extraordinary athlete I'd ever seen. He was the best basketball player in the school. He was a point guard. He was the best baseball pitcher. He picked up a tennis racket, never having taken one lesson, and figured it out and tried out and made the tennis team. He was the quarterback of the football team. He was heavily recruited when he was a senior in college. He smoked dope. He cut class. He sassed the coaches. He did not like being disciplined. And the likely outcome occurred, which is that he never, ever made it to the point where he thought he should have made it. So Elder goes off to college. Elder goes off to law school. Elder goes off to Cleveland, where he works for a law firm. Elder comes back to L.A. and visits his good friend from time to time. And we had a vicious, vicious argument when I come back one year and he changed his name to a Muslim name. He renounced Christianity and hated the white man and had this whole theory about how he was held back by the white man. And I said, hold the phone, my friend. We grew up six blocks away. We went to the same elementary school. We had the same teachers. Went to the same middle school. Went to the same high school. We had the same teachers. We took the same classes. How come the white man didn't stop me? He had no real answer for that. My point is, if you want to think like a victim, you'll have an unlimited supply of victims to choose from. There's always victims. But in America in 2020, can you realize your potential to the greatest degree in human history? And the answer is yes. That's why people are trying to come here. That's why people are braving shark-infested waters, trying to come here from Cuba, because it is a country where, to the greatest extent possible, you can realize your potential. And for anybody who doubts that, did I just sleep through it, or did Barack Obama, a black man with a funny name from Hawaii that nobody ever heard of, become president, knocking out Hillary, and then getting reelected, even though we had a tepid economic recovery, and you're still talking about systemic racism holding you back? I mean, I even heard that in Baltimore after Freddie Gray died. Freddie Gray died in 2015, and this is a city that had a black mayor, still does, and the person running the police department was black. The number two person was black. The state attorney that brought charges against six officers involved in Freddie Gray's death was black. Three of the six officers, black. The judge before whom two of the cases were tried, black. Entire city council was Democrat, majority black. The U.S. attorney at the time, Loretta Lynch, black. And the president of the United States, black. So you have all these black people running things. And as Wanda Sykes, the comedian, once said when Obama got elected, how are you going to complain about the man when you are the man?
Last question, Larry. I know you got to run. What song best defines you? What's your favorite song?
I Won't Back Down, Tom Petty. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
LarryElder.com, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for what you're doing in the world.
And UncleTom.com to see the trailers for the film, and it comes out on the 19th, and you'll be able to see it online through UncleTom.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Larry.
Thank you.